Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This is Martin Lindstrom, author of Small Data, the Tiny Clues That Uncover Huge Trends, and you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast. Named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer in 2016. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's working in modern marketing. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything discussed in the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Today, we're joined by Martin Lindstrom, and we're going to talk about his new book, Small Data, The Tiny Clues That Uncover Huge Trends. Martin Lindstrom is one of the world's premier brand building experts, advising Fortune 100 brands from Coca-Cola to Nestle to Red Bull on how to build future-proof brands. He has carved out a niche as a global expert and pioneer in the fields of consumer psychology, marketing, brands, and neuroscientific research. He has developed an unorthodox way of doing what every company says it wants to do: understand its consumers' deepest desires and turn them into breakthrough products, brands, or retail experiences. Time Magazine has recognized Martin as one of the top 100 most influential people in the world. Recently, an independent study conducted among 30,000 marketers named him the world's number one brand building expert. And since this is the Marketing Book Podcast, I want to share a bit more about his other books. He is a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestselling author of five other groundbreaking books, including Biology, The Truth and Lies About Why We Buy, Brand Sense, and Brand Washed. Biology, spelled B-U-Y-O-L-O-G-Y, was voted Pick of the Year by USA Today and appeared on top 10 bestseller lists in the U.S. and worldwide, including the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. His book, Brand Sense, was acclaimed by the Wall Street Journal as one of the five best marketing books ever published. He's the anchor and producer of NBC's popular TV show, Main Street Makeover, on Today, a columnist for Fast Company and Time, and continues to be featured in the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, The Economist, New York Times, The Washington Post, USA Today, and numerous other publications and television channels worldwide, and now the Marketing Book Podcast. Martin, it's truly an honor to have you on the podcast. Congratulations on Small Data, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas, and thank you for the very flattering introduction. I'm blushing already.
Well, you know, I don't usually describe my guests as kind of a big deal, but that's you, although you probably won't. You wouldn't say that. Now, just right off the bat, Martin, in the book, you talk about, and a lot of my audience is in America, you talk about how Americans don't want to talk about sex, religion, and politics specifically. So if you don't mind, that's all I want to talk about.
I love you already.
Bring it on. In this interview. No, I'm just kidding. But I interview, you know, a lot of very interesting people, many of whom you know. And I just wanted to share one excerpt from the book to give the listener an idea of the lifestyle that you lead and why you're talking to me from a hotel room in New York City right now. Page 4, you say, over the past 15 years, I've interviewed thousands of men, women, and children in their homes in 77 countries. In the past month alone, I've been in New York City, Brussels, Moscow, Dubai, Bahrain, Paris, London, Berlin, Beirut, Shanghai, Beijing, the Maldives, Bucharest, Hong Kong, Salvador, and Sao Paulo. I'm on a plane or inside a hotel room 300 nights a year. The drawbacks of living a life like this are obvious. I can't really call any place home. Relationships are hard to sustain, and children and pets aren't an option. Still, there are benefits. That's just amazing. I know you must take that for granted, but I appreciate you making time for me, and what a life.
Now, when you're reading it back to me, it absolutely sounds like I have no life, and and that my stomach is like an in-flight catering company, right?
Right.
It's probably both is true. But you know what? It's a choice I've made in my life. And people do feel I'm over-exaggerating when I'm saying these numbers, but they actually are true. Because, unfortunately, every major brand happened to have a headquarter, and those headquarters are always placed the most stupid places on planet Earth for some reason, and they're definitely never in the same city.
Uh-huh.
So you need to be on the road. But I do think there's another benefit to this, and that is that it makes me become real, because I literally do live in ordinary consumers' homes, whether that is in a favela in Brazil, or it is in a Saudi Arabian home, or it is in Venezuela or Nigeria, whatever it is. And what happens is that when you are in touch with reality every day, you build up this amazing instinct.
Yes.
Which suddenly makes you, gives you a power to somehow look through walls. And it sounds crazy, but you know, if you've been in 2,000 consumers' homes over the last 10 years, as I've been, you kind of build up an instinct where you actually can predict the color of the wall in the neighbor room. Mm-hmm. And you sort of feel you're crazy when it happens. But actually, it happens more and more. And but the sad side of this is that I think marketeers are hiding behind their glass wall, which is the computer and the iPhones, where the never-ending stream of data coming out of the systems we today have surrounded ourselves with means that we rarely get in contact with reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that we don't get our hands dirty. We don't move in with consumers. We don't see the heartbeat. We think we know it. We think we know the consumer. But you know what? I went to a conference the other day where there was about 2,000 people attending. I asked people in the audience to raise their hand if they spend at least one day with a consumer, a random consumer that didn't know, to learn about the product over the last year. Two people raised their hands. And I think it's very symptomatic for the situation we have today. We've become almost addictive to our own little universe of offices. And we completely disconnected from reality. And that's really my life, the opposite side. And what I'm trying to do with my new book is really to combine those two worlds, almost to build a pipeline from the office straight into a consumer home, right?
Mm-hmm. Let me just, for the benefit of the listener, describe for them the experience of reading the book. And I realize you wrote it, but I don't know that you've gotten feedback like I'm about to give you. Okay.
No, I'm looking forward to it. I'm scared.
No. Well, Martin Lindstrom can handle it. But the book was a sort of an exciting trip around the world, meaning it's 8 chapters. And the first 7 are they almost reminded me of a chase scene from maybe a James Bond or a Jason Bourne movie. It was just, or like maybe the Indiana Jones movie where he's being chased through the marketplace. You know, a lot of those movies will have this sort of colorful, chaotic, I just don't know what's going to happen next, okay? So then I'm reading each one of these and I'm thinking, okay, wow, what's next? And I... What happened was along the way, I was not quite getting how it all fit together, kind of like watching the movie Inception. And then in the 8th chapter, the final chapter, you tied it all together with everything except big explosions. But if someone tries to read the last chapter, I don't think they're going to grasp or they're going to appreciate what's in there. You have to go through and read the first 7 before the 8th one has this enormous payoff. I don't know if that was your intention, but that's what I had.
Goosebumps. You give me goosebumps because that was, in fact, my intention.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah, well, it worked.
Well, listen, here's the reality. No one reads business books anymore. So a friend of mine, he actually placed a $100 note in a range of his books. He's an author. And put them into the distribution channels. And he wrote on the back of the $100 note, if you receive this note, send me an email. He never received an email. And I think it's very symptomatic for the concept of books right now. I'm the same. I mean, first of all, I don't read business books, but I do buy a lot of them because I feel when I read them on the back, I kind of read the entire book. So I decided to say, well, who reads those books? And by the way, why do you read a book? And I noticed time after time that men and women read novels. They read stories and they engage with it. So I wanted to write this as a novel. And it's written like a authentic, real novel. Everything you read about is correct. But it's a story. It's a story where you join me around the world. And then in the end, I've tried to tie together that whole perspective I've seen, which seems very strange as you explore it, in a strategic way so that you can take all that stuff yourself and convert that knowledge I've learned into real actions in your own company or your own business. And it's been a fascinating writing process, I can tell you. It took me 4 years. But it's also a process where I hope that it's a page-turner, because business books rarely are page-turners these days.
It was. And it's what you, for the listener's benefit, at the very end, you tie it all together with this 7C manifesto where companies... I mean, in other words, I'm reading the book. I know this is what you were thinking. I'm reading the book, and I'm thinking, this is great, but how? Where's the thread? How does he do this? How could I possibly, you know, even try to replicate this sort of thing? And then in the very end, you show with seven words that start with C, how companies can start to think this way. And I think that you, and start to do a process like that, and spend a certain amount of time each month doing that. And I think you said it was originally for one of your clients. Was it Nestle?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is incredibly hard to break down your instinct. And that's really what I try to do. You know, when you draw conclusions in mind, whether you come up with a great idea, a creative concept idea, or a strategy, why did you come up with that? And that is the question I've asked myself the last 4 years. How did I come up with a solution for Nestle or for Google or whoever it is we're working with? And time after time, I couldn't answer it. So I've been through a process where I actually started to sort of unpeel my brain. And that led to the 7C manifesto, which actually I think works very well. Mm-hmm. Because we tried really to craft it. And we're using this today for all sorts of companies like Lowe's, which is a supermarket chain here in the US, and a range of other companies like Lego. And the process is really to create an instinct in your mind, if you haven't done what I'm doing, it is to read the consumer's mind. It is to sit in a home, in a random home somewhere in North Carolina, wherever you are, and sit in front of a consumer and pick down details about that person's life, which will surprise everyone. Because those insights create the foundation for your new brand. And I call those small and seemingly insignificant observations for small data. And because mm-hmm. they, in contrast to big data, are showing the causation, so the reason why something is happening, rather than big data, which is all about correlation.
Yeah, and now I've got another book on my desk here about big data. I interviewed one of the authors earlier this year. It's called The Big Data Driven Business.
Yeah,
great book. It introduced the idea of what it actually is. And for me, the term big data is being used amongst marketers and so many folks these days. It reminds me of 20 years ago, people saying, what is this internet thing?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they don't, and it seems to be sucking all the oxygen out of the room. And
absolutely.
Like almost as if there's a crutch.
Yeah.
And so can you explain a little bit more about the small, what you call the small data revolution, and why it's, say a little bit more about why it's so important not to leave it all to big data?
Yeah. Well, I think as everything is the case in our life, we need a counterbalance, because whenever we're all out of balance as human beings, and as soon as things are out of balance, it also indicates a need. And quite often to identify those needs, which then can be fulfilled with a brand or a product or a service, well, then you need to identify that need, and you can't do that with big data, because big data is all about finding correlations. But you need to have a hypothesis first for what you're looking for, mm-hmm. and a data miner can't do that, because that's not their job. Their job is to crunch numbers, but you need to know what numbers to crunch. So you need to pick up those subconscious clues. And I think the best example really is a true story from 2002, where the Lego company was struggling to survive. And Lego had come up with the conclusion, based on big data, that the instant gratification generation had arrived. And that meant that the concept of Lego was dead, because what kid would spend thousands or hundreds or tens of hours on building Lego boxes or Lego bricks if they would not have the patience for it? So Lego concluded they had to change the size of the Lego bricks. And they did that. They changed it from those tiny small bricks to large building blocks. Mm-hmm. And the sales went down dramatically. So close so much that they were close to bankruptcy in 2002. Now, that was really where the story of Small Data began, because a small team from Lego went into the home of a very young consumer, an 11-year-old German boy, and the first question they asked him was, "What are you most proud of?" And he looked around in his room and he pointed at a shelf, and on the shelf there was an old worn-down sneaker, and he said, "That one." And the team was a bit sort of surprised. They said, "Why?" He said, "Well, because if you look at the worn-down sneaker, the wear and the tear it has on the sole, it means I am the best skater in town. Because exactly that ankle means I can slide down that skateboard. And this is really my evidence to my friends that I'm number one." It was kind of a trophy for this kid. And that was a wake-up call for Lego, because they realized that if you give the kids the chance to be the leader, to put them in the driver's seat, so to speak, they would actually spend hundreds, if not thousands of hours on their obsession, in this case, skateboarding. And what is so interesting was that out of that, Lego did two things. They changed the size of the Lego brick from these building blocks to small bricks again. And they also came up later on with the idea of the Lego Movie, which really is a storytelling device to put kids in the driver's seat. And I guess the rest is history. Lego is number one today. But it is also the birth of Small Data, coming out of a real-world experience where I think a lot of us marketeers across the world have become blind, because we do sort of are told somehow by people around us that big data will give us the answer. I mean, every time I go to a conference, people are talking about big data at least 10 times. At every boardroom meeting I have, it's mentioned. And it blinds you, but the reality is that you need something else.
Mm-hmm. The questions at the very end, you talk about it. And of course, it was sort of like the first seven chapters were magic tricks. And then at the very end, in the eighth, like Penn and Teller, you show us how you did it.
Yeah.
Well, part of them, it talked about what are you most proud of, or what is most important in your life? What worries you the most? These come in different sections, but it was really revealing. And, you know, it reminded me of marketing and sales, where there are a lot of people, you know, humans seem to love crutches, and there are a lot of people that think, you know, if you're just generating leads online and you're getting people to your website and they're showing an interest, you don't really need to reach out to people and call them or interact with them. And I think it's a fantasy. People want that, but there's not that still that human element is so very important.
It is, because you have to remember that when we fall in love with people, when we spend time with people at dinners, it's because we are attracted by the five senses, mm-hmm. which is also, I guess, the topic I wrote about back in 2003 with one of my books. The five senses tell signals which you cannot obtain in data. And I think if you really want to make people fall in love with a brand, using Kevin Roberts' phrase, or if you want people to truly be engaged, creating tribes, creating evangelism, being passionate, almost religious, obsessed with a brand, I think you also need to appeal to them in a human way. And you just can't do that by numbers. You need to understand the true human being. And I think this is really the role of a marketeer. That is to be the spearhead of understanding human beings. We cannot do that in front of a computer screen only. So this book is really the bridge from the office into the reality. And hopefully it makes things become so tangible that actually everyone will say, "Hey, I want to give this a go." Certainly what I've said to my clients around the world is, let's introduce a new rule. Whenever you get a job at this company, whether that is the Pepsi's of the world or Nestle's of the world or a small startup business, let's make sure that every staff member spends at least 2 days a year in a consumer's home. Mm-hmm. And it's become the rule for most of my clients. And every time they come back to me and say, it changed our organization.
Yes, yes. And I was just talking to a company the other day, and they were looking at hiring us. And one of the things we talked about is, I'm going to need to talk to some of your customers. And they just thought, why?
Yeah.
But it's such a time well spent. Even if I can only talk to them on the phone, but if I can go visit them, it's even better. Just because there's the book helped me appreciate the value of why we've been doing that. Also, but let me ask you this: what about those people who say, "Well, we don't want to base big business decisions on just a few qualitative encounters with customers"?
Well, I went to the doctor in Switzerland the other day to have my yearly health check, and when he took a blood sample of me, I didn't ask him to take 6 gallons of blood from me just to be double sure, right?
I'm glad you didn't, or we wouldn't be talking today.
Yeah. Well, you know, he took 2 drops, and that was enough for him to assess my health status. It's a little bit the same here, because when you take 2 drops, it's a whole science behind this, making it possible to assess the health condition of a person. And in many ways, it's the same when you interview, in my case, it's typically 40 or 50 people. That's it to turn around a brand. But you have to do 2 things. You have to choose those people incredibly carefully, because they will become representative in your brain for what the world is like. But it's not about quantity, because quantity in many ways is, I leave it up to big data to do the quantitative part, because that's where you find the correlation. I leave it up to the small data to find the hypotheses, and then you can verify later on the volume of it. And the second thing I want to say is that as you do these investigations, you realize that these people are not just telling about their lives. If they're truly representative, they represent a lot of other people and the surroundings and the ambience. And all that stuff fills out a picture which you in no way would be able to do using other methodologies. So it's very powerful. And I have to tell you, the only way and the best way I'm persuading my clients to do it is I'm saying to them, I'll do it with you. And I take the CEO with me typically. And I'll tell you a fun story. For one of my clients, I took the CEO with me. It's one of the biggest food companies in the world. We slept together in a sleeping bag. Can you believe it? 2 different sleeping bags, though.
Talk about getting close to your clients.
Yeah, exactly. On the floor at a young lady's house in Shanghai while she was running around preparing stuff. And that was extraordinary experience, because not only did I get close to my client, right, but we also both saw the world from the same point of view. And that later on actually resulted in a revolution in that company, in the food industry, because he said to me, every one of my staff members around the world need to do the same. They need to live in a consumer's home, because it's 10 times more convincing than watching or reading a report of 200 pages, right?
Or sitting behind a two-way mirror, yeah, watching a focus group.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it brought to mind, I don't know if you're familiar with it, there's a show called Undercover Boss.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, it's a British show originally.
Oh, okay. And like a lot of good American TV shows, like The Office. And there's a similar thing that happens there where the boss is, I guess, a customer, or he pretends to be an employee. But just doing that, I guess just a few times, gives him all kinds of insights into some of the problems his customers are having with his company, or maybe some of the problems he's having with an employee.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think each research methodology, of course, has its strength. I think in many ways, of course, quantitative research is almost like an onion. It can give you sort of the outer layer. And then it may be that you can do focus groups, which can do the next layer. Mm-hmm. The problem with focus groups is that everyone follows everyone. I mean, we are members of a tribe, all of us. So if one person have a very strong opinion and another person have the same opinion, and a third person have the same opinion, and there is 7 people in the room, you can be sure that the 4 other people will follow those 3 people. And suddenly you won't get the reality out of them. Whereas if it's one-on-one in their homes, where they're taking off the shoes, they have no makeups on, the kids are running around, they can't hide reality, and you can read the room. You can look at the size of the paintings, the way they place the toothbrush, mm-hmm, or the music they're playing, or the DVDs they have on the shelf. And that in its own right are opening a whole chapter into a world which they will never ever talk about in a focus group. And that's where you'll learn where the heart is beating, right?
Yeah, and you talk about, I think one of the best interviews you ever had is where you showed up accidentally an hour early customer's home, and she hadn't taken a shower, she hadn't put her makeup on, she was in her bathrobe, and you apologized, and she said, just come on in.
And it was, and you're so right, it was one of the best interviews ever, because she was so honest. In fact, it comes back to one of the things I'm talking about in the book called Embodied Cognition. Mm-hmm. It's a study which was done a couple of years ago, actually, in New York City, where people are giving the option to wear a white lab coat. And they had 3 different lab coats, one where it said doctor, one where it was a dentist, one where it was nothing. And there was, of course, a control group, A and B control group. So the first group was just a generic group. The second one was where they actually went through this experiment. And as they wore that lab coat with the doctor's sort of sign on, they became not only faster at answering things, it also became more accurate what they were answering. And even the self-confidence level went up compared to the generic lab coat. This is called embodied cognition, and it really is transformation. And I talk a lot about how to create transformation in people's lives in my book, because I think it's a big next thing right now, to be honest. But I also talk a lot about how embodied cognition takes place when we are in certain environments. If I sit in a focus group room, there's one set of embodied cognition, which is I want to be formal because I want to show I am a serious person, whereas at home I can't do that. And it was interesting because the current Prime Minister of England, Cameron, he actually was interviewed recently by BBC in his kitchen. And the interviewer, when I talked to him later on, said to me it was the best interview you ever done with the Prime Minister. Well, by the way, the Prime Minister told some stuff he never said on television before and regretted it later on because he was at home, because he had his guards down. And I think that's the essence of small data.
Interesting, interesting. It reminds me of President Obama went to be interviewed by a very famous podcaster, Mark Maron, at Mark Maron's garage in Southern California. And it was a very interesting interview. It was not the kind the president of the U.S. does either. So that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Let me ask one other quick question here. You talk at the towards the end of the book about the fear of losing their branded identities is why some CEOs and senior executives spend almost no time with their customers. Can you expand on that? Explain more about that?
Well, you have to remember that first of all, when you sit in a very nice fancy office, you have a certain identity, and that identity is established around the fact that you wear a tie, that you have a fancy watch, you have a really high title on your business card, and you have a lot of people looking up to you. If I take you out in a consumer's home and do what we call subtexting, because this is called a subtext research when you do this small data stuff, when I do that, you cannot wear your tie, you cannot wear your fancy watch, your business card is out of the window and no one respects you because you are just a human being. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, it's really revealing. I mean, in the beginning when I did this stuff somewhere in the world, I felt lost. I felt like a nobody. And it was not only revealing about myself how insecure I was as a person, that I was really dependent on that stuff I was wearing, but it also told me that as I'm communicating with a person at my own level, because we're just two ordinary people, a little bit like what they do in Finland, believe it or not, when they're doing tough negotiations, they undress and go into a sauna and negotiate, which is something they've done for hundreds of years because they know you will talk to the real person and not to everything around that person. Well, that's what you do here. CEOs today are afraid of leaving the office and leaving that environment. Of course, there's exceptions, but I mean, when I ask them to go into the real homes, it typically is a process where it takes me half a year to convince the CEO to go with me. And they only do it because I basically tease them so much it becomes almost embarrassing if they don't do it. But every time after that, they actually continue to do it every month. And I've not met one single CEO which is not doing it or stopped doing it after I worked with them. They all continue doing it, right?
I had to ask myself when I was reading the book, you would tell these stories about how you would be in the bedroom of a teenager or just some of the most out of the way places, like your story about being in the sleeping bag with the CEO. And I just wanted to say, back up, how in the world did you do that? I mean, what did you have to go through to get to that? And there's not enough room in the book for that, but
well,
it was fascinating.
It is fascinating. And it's actually not as difficult as it sounds like. Sometimes I have some really nice clients which are willing to invest the money in making it happen. I mean, the opening chapter is all about me flying around in a private jet, can you believe it, paid by this client. And God bless him that he was willing to invest in that on little me. But we literally flew around in Siberia, which were really fascinating, because Siberia is big. I mean, we flew 1 hour every day, and after 7 days, there was 7 hours time difference from Moscow, and we were half an hour away from Tokyo. I mean, this is big stuff. So you had to fly that way to get to all these homes across Siberia.
You changed crews, I think.
Same
plane, different crews.
We had, because we're not allowed to fly that far. And we even had pilots coming on board navigating us around military zones. But what was interesting was when I went out of this plane, I dressed, undressed from my black uniform clothes. I'm always wearing black to clothes representing the society in where I was living. And I sort of went from this corporate, very fancy world, I have to admit, into a world where people literally were dying on the street and there was rats on the floor in the apartments and living there for 2 or 3 days and basically living their lives. And it was just very surreal, but it not only gave me a wake-up call and made me realize how lucky I am, but also it gave me a real sense of reality. I mean, these people, no one had been visiting them before, and every time I learned something, and that helped me not just to develop a strategy in Russia, but actually that combined with what I learned in Saudi Arabia doing something similar actually helped to turn around a supermarket chain in North Carolina. So, I mean, this is where it starts to be crazy and where I'm that you're saying, what went on here? But that's well, what you're learning
you were
about.
Comparing Siberia to Saudi Arabia, and I thought, all right, now I want to see this.
Yeah.
And then you explain it. It was just fascinating. And we won't go into it, but there is one part of the book where you talk about how you were almost kidnapped in South America. And
yeah, that's true. Yeah, it was scary. Yeah. And when you try these experiences, you sort of – you never realize it in the moment, and then you look back and you just have a story for life for your grandchildren. Right.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen to you again. But boy, when you got to that story, I had already been thinking, like, you know, this can't be the only dangerous thing that's happened to this guy.
No, that's true.
So, Martin, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I would hope it would be that they will say to themselves, gee, I'm not present anymore in my life. I mean, we all are so obsessed with our smartphones that we rarely look up. I don't have a phone anymore. And I decided to quit it altogether because I was not present and I want to be present. I want to see people around me. And the more I do that, the more present I become, the better I am at observing things. I think most of us today have come to a life where we become addicted to this stuff. And because of that, we do not see, hear, smell, touch, and taste the world around us. And the biggest and most important role for a marketeer is to be exactly that. That is to observe the world, because you are the link between the consumer and the brand. And if you are not there, who is going to create that link? So that is to wake up, and hopefully the book is giving you a concrete sort of recipe of how you wake up and how you translate what you've learned from that wake-up call into reality and transform brands and companies as a result of that.
Excellent. Are there any recent and or upcoming marketing books that you recommend or are looking forward to seeing?
Well, I had to tell you something which I hope you don't find arrogant in any way, but I don't read books at all.
Really? And
yeah, no, because I'm so afraid of stealing ideas. So I stopped.
Interesting,
reading books.
Yeah.
I, you know, I would hate that situation of reading a book and then saying to myself, why did I come up with that idea? And I'd be crazy. So no, I don't read books anymore. That's not to say that I don't like business books, but I think as an author, I made that conscious decision because I want all my materials to be 100% fresh. And I hope you feel that when you read Small Data, that is not just another book coming out on the shelf. It actually is something which is transforming your behavior. So unfortunately, I can't help you.
Well, that's very interesting. So you don't have a phone and you don't read books.
No wonder
you can write books like Small Data. Well, thank you for writing it. That's very interesting answer, and I completely respect it and I understand it. So if listeners want to find out more about you and your books, would they go to martinlindstrom.com?
Yeah, that's a good start. And there you actually, by the way, can see the trailer for my books. We produced quite a lot of trailers where I had a camera crew following me around the world as I was working, doing my job. Also, you can go on Facebook. So facebook.com/martinlindstrom. Or on Twitter or on LinkedIn. On Facebook, I'm updating stuff every day about my life and what's going on.
We'll make sure to include links to all of those on the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com so the listener can find them. Let me just read one short excerpt from the very end, if you still have time.
Absolutely.
If companies want to understand consumers, big data offers a valuable but incomplete solution. I would argue that our contemporary preoccupation with digital data endangers high-quality insights and observations, and thus products and product solutions. And that, for all the valuable insights big data provides, the web remains a curated, idealized version of who we really are. Most illuminating to me is combining small data with big data by spending time in homes watching, listening, noticing, and teasing out clues to what consumers really want. The name of the book is Small Data, The Tiny Clues That Uncover Huge Trends. The author is Martin Lindstrom. Martin, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast, and I hope that when you write your seventh book, you'll consider coming back.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. I appreciate it. Thanks for some really good questions.
And that closes the book on the 59th episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. But please don't let the end of this episode be the end of what you can learn about modern marketing. Visit marketingbookpodcast.com for show notes, free resources, and marketing guides. And while there, be sure to join the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And if you love the show, please do me a favor. Open up a browser on your phone or computer and type in love.marketingbookpodcast.com. That's love.marketingbookpodcast.com. That will generate a pre-formatted tweet with a link to the show that you can share with your world on Twitter. And you'll get a personal thank you from me for spreading the love. And please join us next time as we talk with the one and only, the man, the myth, the legend, the incomparable Jay Baer about his new book, Hug Your Haters, How to Embrace Complaints and Keep Your Customers. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.